You can find information about subscribing to this series at netrf.org/podcast, where you'll also find helpful charts, graphs, and videos that expand on this material. If you're new to NetWise, we strongly recommend you go back and listen to the series from the beginning, starting with episode 1. It will give you a solid grounding in the basics of neuroendocrine tumors and how they're treated. You can find the whole series at netrf.org/podcast and wherever you get your podcasts. Do you have a story to tell about your own NET journey? If you're a NET patient who would like to participate in a future episode, please email us and let us know. podcast@netrf.org. Welcome to NetWise. This is a podcast for neuroendocrine cancer patients and caregivers that presents expert information and patient perspectives. I'm Elise Gellerman from the Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation. In today's episode, we're going to talk about the experiences of adolescents and young adults living with NETs. They are often referred to as AYA, NET patients. It's a group that faces a very specific set of challenges and needs particular kinds of help navigating through the NET journey. To begin with, what is the definition of a young adult when it comes to cancer care? Well, it depends on who you ask and where you are in the world. Here's Dr. Mark Lewis, Director of Gastrointestinal Oncology for Intermountain Healthcare, which serves patients in Utah, Idaho, and Nevada. He's also a NET patient himself. He was diagnosed with a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor at the age of 30.
So adolescent and young adult patients, actually the definition varies by country. So the United States has the broadest definition, which is an age range that spans from 15 to 39. Which obviously is extremely broad and covers a lot of biology and even psychosocial circumstance. And this is a group that's near and dear to me because until quite recently, I was considered a young adult and I've now aged just barely out of that category. But when I was first diagnosed with neuroendocrine tumors, I did fit pretty squarely in the middle of what we consider AYA.
Because there is such a broad range of life stages within the under 40 group, we're going to narrow it down for this episode and concentrate on those who are diagnosed at age 30 or younger. People wrestling with the question of what it means to live with cancer as teenagers or college students or just beginning their professional lives. And unfortunately, while NETs remain rare among young people, the rate of diagnosis is increasing. Here's Dr. Manisha Shah, a medical oncologist at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center.
There is definitely an increase in the frequency of young adults that I see, male and female, less than 40, less than even 30.
As with the rise in NET patients in general, some of this has to do with better diagnostic techniques and increased knowledge of the disease among physicians. But that doesn't seem to completely explain the trend.
So I do think that the part of this increase that we're seeing relates to, people seeking more medical care, more active participation in their health, more testing done for one reason or the other, having sensitive tests available. So it's kind of that's part of increase, but other part of increase seems a true increase in the frequency of these diseases. I wish I knew the answer why we're seeing the increase so we can work on the prevention strategies, but we don't really know.
And actually, the number of younger people living with NETs is probably much higher than we realize, because AYA patients are especially likely to be misdiagnosed, sometimes for a long time. Here's Dr. Hydera Del Rivero, a researcher at the National Cancer Institute at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland.
The young adult population, sometimes we don't diagnose them earlier enough because it's not like adult. We already have standardized, procedures like colonoscopy, endoscopy that the patients undergo. But for the young adults or pediatric, it's not that simple.
You know, we wouldn't think abdominal pain, there is something seriously wrong with these patients because they are young. The abdominal pain, diarrhea would be labeled as like irritable bowel syndrome or indigestion, some abdominal pain related to maybe the exercise pattern they have, that, musculoskeletal pain. and shortness of breath would be more like anxiety or panic attacks.
For some of the same reasons that clinicians do not always consider the possibility of cancer when diagnosing health problems in teens and young adults, a cancer diagnosis is a shock for young people.
While none of us want to get sick, when a young person gets sick, it's like an extra hard blow, because we're supposed to be just living normal life. We're not ready to have any diseases.
Here's Kaylin Fletcher, a licensed independent clinical social worker who runs a support group for young adults with cancer at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston.
Fear, denial, how could this be me? I think that's the biggest thing I see is, I was just at the gym last week and, you know, going on a date. How could this be real? It's this sense of shock because there's no real reference point. Most people in this age group really don't have a lot of experience with serious illness. So it can really kind of feel alienating to be the person who has this serious illness and, you know, needing to explain that to people and just feeling different.
They also tend to suffer longer without a diagnosis. So they have a lot of things to process about emotionally, to say, gosh, you know, these over the last 2 years, I was told that all I have is irritable bowel syndrome and now I have stage 4 cancer. So these kind of anger or mistrust to the medical system that we cannot blame them for because that's what they have experienced. And so now to start this new stage where they have to be able to trust the medical system is another layer that comes into the conversation. Fundamentally, they have to know that this is a new step and we want to set it in the right direction.
Let's look at how these emotional and lifestyle challenges present themselves in two distinct groups within the AYA spectrum, starting with that first A, adolescents.
These are patients who can have disease diagnosed at the advanced stage or disease diagnosed incidentally at early stage.
The youngest I have seen here at the clinical center has been 14 years old.
Teenagers really are, as we've long recognized in society, their own group. I think it's a very liminal phase where you're trying to establish your identity, and it's a really tricky time to be dealing with any sort of serious illness. It can really disrupt sort of how you perceive yourself and how you start planning for your future. And I think it is really knocking some people off their trajectory. You know, I think when you're coming out of high school, you sort of imagine your life being very linear. And if there's anything I've learned is that it is very nonlinear. I think that John Lennon said it best when he said, life is what happens when you're making other plans. And so I think it's very common to sort of think of your life in blocks. And you do 4 years of college and then you get a job and you start a family. But I think any cancer, but particularly NET syndromes and especially hereditary NET syndromes can really disrupt that.
One of the many problems teenagers with cancer face is that they can find themselves in a kind of middle space within the medical system, caught somewhere between pediatrics and adult medicine and not completely belonging in either.
Pediatric and adult oncology are different specialties. The line between those groups is pretty thick and impermeable in terms of our training. But biologically, it's not. So age is a continuous variable. You have to choose where you're going to draw your line. And my point is that many adult oncologists are actually not that comfortable taking care of teenagers, whereas many pediatric oncologists are not that comfortable taking care of young adults. So the teenagers sometimes kind of get caught in the middle.
Even within the NET community, adolescent patients can have a hard time finding information that applies to them. While NET primaries that are common in older adults, like pancreas and lung, can also occur in adolescents, other primaries that are extremely rare in older people, such as NETs of the adrenal gland, can be among the most common in young people. Even the treatment strategies that doctors apply to NETs are not frequently studied in younger patients.
The way we treat the pediatric population is based on the adult studies, and they have some adjustments in the dose based on their height and their weight. And then whether that's affected, as we have seen on the adults, is something that is a question that to me is an answer, and I think further studies needs to be done.
Some good news about adolescent NETs is that with current care, many patients can live with the disease for a long time.
I have actually had to conceive of my own illness as chronic, something I will never be cured of, but one that still allows me to work and be productive and do something I find very fruitful. I'm very, very blessed in that.
But managing NETs as a long-term condition also presents specific challenges. This includes thinking about downstream side effects that wouldn't present an issue for a geriatric patient. If a treatment might have a serious side effect 20 or 30 years down the line, that's not much of a concern for a patient in their 80s, but it might be a very serious concern for a patient who is 18.
You have to exist in the moment and cure the person of the disease if you can, but you also have to think about how are you affecting this person in the long run? And it's hard not to sound ageist, but that really is part of the calculus when you're taking care of young people. The average age of a patient in my practice is 68. And so there's less years of life to protect, is one way of looking at it, when you're treating an older person as opposed to life years gained treating a younger person.
This might make a clinician think twice about giving a treatment to a young person that they would have no hesitation recommending to an older one with the same diagnosis.
I think the one that probably bothers me the most, to be honest with you, is the notion of using PRRT, so peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, in a young person, because we know that there's this small, but again, non-zero risk of causing leukemia. And we don't yet know exactly how that risk plays out over time. One argument actually is that it's more likely to happen in older adults who already have sort of less bone marrow resilience than it is in kids. But I would be a little bit hesitant using a therapy with that potential devastating long-term toxicity in a child.
And in addition to the long-term and cumulative effects of different treatment options, the cumulative effect of radiation exposure from imaging also has to be considered.
So when you get a CT scan, it's a glorified stack of x-rays. That's literally what it is x-ray upon x-ray that then reconstructed in the computer. So CT is computed tomography. So it's putting it all together, really allowing us to reconstruct you in 3D if we want. But a standard CT scan, say of the abdomen and pelvis, is 200 x-rays. And for a long time in oncology, the dominant paradigm had us scanning people every 3 months. So if you do that over 5 years, that's 4,000 x-rays, which in someone who's already had cancer is potentially enough to stimulate another one. So one of the things I'm very cognizant of in myself and in patients I'm following over time is radiation burden.
Carrying the weight of all these new challenges, both medical and social, can unfortunately sometimes cause teenagers with NETs to develop an unhelpful or even self-destructive attitude toward managing their disease. This can take the form of either ignoring potential consequences or wallowing in them.
With young adults, you know, there could be scenarios where they have these sort of a positive attitude, everything is going to be okay. So this sense of taking things lightly, and so I try to emphasize the seriousness of this disease and the long-term consequences of this disease.
I will say I've seen several teenagers who unfortunately are prone to nihilism, meaning that they get a diagnosis like this that's really serious and they sort of feel like this is the end for them, where in fact we hope that we can give them many decades, not just of life, but of good quality life where they can be productive and achieve all their goals. So I often tell patients at the beginning, I intend to have a relationship with them therapeutically that lasts decades, and I don't want them to fall into the self-fulfilling prophecy of nihilism where they sort of forego care that can be life-preserving because they just assume it's all for naught.
So I think that is kind of the first thing, to just get on the same wavelength about what this disease is and what its implications can be in their lives and their family and friends' lives. The goal here is to really open up the space where they can be living their life as fully as possible so that we are not imposing limitations. We don't want them to clear up rest of their life to just be a full-time patient and talk about like, okay, I have these, I have that, you know, now I can't get married or I can't have travel. Not let cancer cripple you, because that would serve no purpose, whether one has 2 weeks to live or 2 years or 20 years to live or longer. And that's what we are here to help them live their life to their fullest potential.
My name is Aunt Sophia Hurtado. I am 17 years old. I turned 18 on October 25th, and I was diagnosed in January of 2019, the 31st, with a neuroendocrine pancreatic tumor with metastases in my liver as well, and I live in Sunrise, Florida.
My name is Marianne Hurtado. I am Sophia's mother. I am a native of the North Shore of Boston, but we are living here in South Florida, and I am an English teacher at a local private school.
Basically, I was diagnosed when I was in my sophomore year of high school. Freshman year, I had symptoms, you know, slowly coming on. But sophomore year, mentally, I was just checked out because my hormones were so crazy and out of whack that I couldn't even pay attention in class anymore.
You know, now knowing what I know now, I realize it started even before that because of the way neuroendocrine tumors grow. But there were little signs, you know, she started her period and then she stopped getting her period. So I did what I was supposed to do. I took her to the doctor. They did an ultrasound and they said, oh, everything's okay. You know, let's give it another year. And then, so, okay. Then there was the weight gain and I said, well, you know, I'm heavy. So I was like, okay, that might be a little bit normal. And then at Christmas time, we were actually up in Massachusetts and she was just so sick and she wasn't herself and she was tired and she was cranky.
I am a cheerleader, so I was always very active and I was running at least 2 laps a day around the track field and, you know, doing exercises, and I was very social. But there came a point in time where I would get out of breath. I couldn't go upstairs. Like, my body weight was just so heavy that I couldn't pick myself up off the ground or get upstairs. And my legs were swollen, my face, I gained weight in my face.
And my husband, who went to Nicaragua to see his family at Christmas, and then between him going there and then us going to Boston, coming home, he didn't see her in about 3 weeks. And he saw her at the beginning of January. He's like, Marianne, there's something wrong. She doesn't even look like the same kid she did when I left 3 weeks ago. Her face is huge and it's round. Next day, went to school. She checks her. I sent her to the clinic to get her blood pressure taken. It was 152 over, you know, 124. So it was the blood pressure, the high blood pressure that keyed me into there was something drastically wrong. I called the doctor and I went in that afternoon and we just happened to hit the right doctor at the right time. He took the blood pressure. He's like, oh, wow, you know, you need to take her to the ER. She's having a hypertensive crisis. I go, okay. And then as I was walking out the door, he goes, tell him I think it's Cushing syndrome. I go, Cushing's? What's that? He goes, don't worry about it. Very rare. I'm sure she doesn't have it. Just tell him I said that. And because he said that to me, it made all the difference, because when I went to the emergency room and they started looking her over and I said that, they had to look. And that's when they did the blood levels, and the cortisol in her blood was so high that they kind of figured it wasn't just a pituitary one, and then they did scans and they found out the next day that she had a 16 centimeter tumor on her pancreas. Listen, when we found out about what was actually involved with this, you know, neck tumor, and what the prognosis and all of those things were, my husband and I, we prayed and we just begged God for time. Our decision was, if we, you know, maybe if we just have time with Sophia, maybe they'll come up with a cure. And we begged God for time.
I get the question a lot of, why are you fighting so hard? What are you fighting for? And how do you stay so strong? And I have people calling me their hero. And I'm like, you know what? Quitting to me was never an option. Like, it never even crossed my mind to give up. And I'm just so thankful for this opportunity and all the support and all the love that I get from people.
So we're just, you know, gonna buckle down and do what we have to do to get more time.
Let's look now at the situation for NET patients in their 20s. out of high school and just beginning their lives as adults.
So developmentally, this is just a really challenging life stage for, you know, folks in their 20s and 30s. There's usually just a lot going on, even without a cancer diagnosis. Most people are really discovering their identity independent of their parents and families. They're beginning to make their own money and make financial decisions. They're deciding who they want to spend their time with. And many, many folks are beginning to think about serious romantic partnerships and family planning. So therefore, if you put a cancer diagnosis into all of this, it's really emotionally confusing and complicated.
These complications exist on several levels for young adult NET patients, starting with basic questions of logistics and finances. Very few people in their early 20s come to a cancer diagnosis with the financial resources or the experience with the healthcare system that's required to address all the issues they may face.
One of the huge things to talk about is insurance. Things really change at age 26. And so again, this is going to be the case for as long as we have the Affordable Care Act. So under the ACA, you know, you can get coverage under your parents, so sort of living under that umbrella, up until 26. And then we've noticed a drastic shift in financial toxicity as people then get into their very late 20s. And it's because largely they're having to acquire their own healthcare coverage. And I often feel like it's double jeopardy because a lot of healthcare coverage in this country, as you know, is tied to your job. And if you're too sick to be employed, then it's very, very difficult to secure affordable health insurance. So it's almost like these young people sort of get hit both ways. And we've seen that be an enormous struggle. Some of the treatments we're talking about are hugely expensive. I mean, I often tell patients that if you're just paying market price, PRT probably costs something on the order of $160,000 over the four treatments. That's money that, you know, very few young adults are going to have unless they have a trust fund. And so you can see how readily treatment for NETs can bankrupt you. And again, it can hit you both ways. It can make you less employable and it can make your coverage more expensive.
Young adults who are too sick to continue working will often need to explore applying for programs like Social Security disability benefits in order to support themselves.
And that's really challenging for anyone. However, most folks in their 20s have never even thought of applying for disability or taking time away from school or work. And it's really hard to put a pause on those things.
And perhaps most dauntingly, many people who are seriously sick for the first time are surprised to discover that managing their care is largely their own responsibility. Not only is it up to patients to make decisions about how and when and where to be treated, but they're also largely responsible for managing their own medical records and making sure that all the members of their care team have the information they need.
So one thing that young patients really have to be very aware of is when their care is being transferred. So again, classically, if you've been a teenager and now you're entering the world of adult oncology, you're probably going to change oncologists. There are some pediatric oncologists that, for sake of continuity, will continue following that same person even as they age out of the demographic. But there's also the case where it's almost like passing the baton, where an adult oncologist like me will sort of inherit a case from a pediatric oncologist. And again, I don't want to put too much of the onus on the patient, but they have to realize in that transfer that one of the things that has to happen is very exact, granular information about what treatments they've had before. Sometimes when I talk to patients, and this happens regardless of age, I'll say, you know, what treatment have you had before? They'll say, oh, chemo. But that word is meaningless. That's like saying, you know, I got an antibiotic. It just refers to a class of drugs. It doesn't give me any really meaningful information. So actually one thing that's happened in the AYA space that's been fascinating, at least to help with this, is this notion of passports. So actually giving the patients either written or increasingly digital sort of ways to track the treatments they've had, and sort of make them the ambassadors of their own information.
What I always tell patients is that the patients are my collaborators, and I really am very grateful for this collaboration. Many of the ideas, many of the energy that I get to do what I do comes from this one-on-one conversation between patients and myself. And so I'm very grateful for that.
Added to these logistical challenges are tremendous social challenges as well, learning new ways to deal with the people around you. Unfortunately, interpersonal relationships of all kinds can be stretched, strained, and turned around by a cancer diagnosis, and learning to navigate these changes can take time. For young adults, this often starts with their relationships with their parents.
The dynamics that parents and children have, like adult children, can be really complicated, as we know. It's also very common during this time that parents often kind of regress. They see their child, even though it's their adult child, you know, really sick, and they kind of go back to how they acted when their kid was 3 or 4. And I see that a lot, where they just kind of want to be, you know, all hands on deck, really involved, there all the time.
The truth is that even as a young adult, you are an adult. And the ultimate decision maker about your care is you. This can be overwhelming, but it can also be empowering. Who you allow in your circle, and when, and for how long, is your decision, and something you can take control of at a time when it feels like everything is out of your control. If and when you tell your friends or classmates or the people you work with about your medical status is completely up to you. It can be a challenge also in the phase of life when many are solidifying their sense of self to make sure your identity isn't completely consumed by the cancer.
I think that that is one of the biggest fears of especially younger folks with cancer is, you know, I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be the person like, oh, the friend who has cancer all the time. And I think, you know, for some folks, you know, taking control of that and setting boundaries with friends, you know, for 20 minutes of our time today, we can talk about my cancer. We can talk about, you know, what's going on with me. But then I want to switch gears because I want to hear about what's going on with you. I want to talk about like the Bachelorette from last week. I want to talk about the other things that make me me, and realizing that, you know, cancer is a piece of your identity and it's always going to be, but it's not all of it by any means. So making sure to kind of set the tone with friends and family can be really helpful. And that takes work. That definitely takes work, and it takes practice.
It's important work though, because building and maintaining positive relationships with friends and family can be one of the most important things a patient can do to make their life better.
I have definitely experienced patients who are just like, I'm done. I'm just going to kind of hole up and not talk to anyone. And, you know, that's really hard. And it's something that I work, you know, a lot with people who are, you know, just kind of turn inward. And over time, people tend to realize that social support is one of the best tools for getting through a cancer diagnosis, getting through cancer treatment. With that said, patients tend to figure out on their own, you know, who the people are who are going to be most supportive to them, who they're going to want to, you know, come to appointments with them, who they're going to want to talk to about their hard days. And there are going to be certain people, especially, you know, like within a peer group, within a friend group, who might not be able to tolerate that, and who might not be the best, you know, to go to for all those things. And it might surprise you. Oftentimes I have patients who are like, you know, the people I was expecting to kind of be there and be like my go-tos were not, but the people that I did not anticipate to be there all the time were. They were the people who I wanted to come to appointment, like hard appointments with me. And I wanted to talk to about, you know, the really tough stuff.
An unfortunate truth about cancer treatment is that some of the medications and procedures that might be crucial for saving someone's life can have serious consequences for that person's ability to have children.
When one enters into the advanced stage therapeutics, certainly we have several targeted therapies as well as cytotoxic chemotherapies that are definitely high risk for causing infertility.
So some of the drugs that we use in NETs, not many of them, but some, are alkylating agents, and they can damage a woman's ovaries and make it almost impossible or much more difficult, at least for her, to have children. So that actually is a conversation that we often have in AYA oncology, whether we're dealing with NETs or not.
In young adults, this can force really consequential decisions that they might not have been ready to make.
Yeah, the fertility piece is really hard because it's another thing that feels like it's being taken completely out of your control. And oftentimes for folks in their, especially in their 20s, most of my patients aren't really thinking of having kids, you know, in the next year or so, but having, you know, fertility impacted by treatment forces them to kind of think about that and whether they even want kids before they're ready and before they wanted to.
Am I going to get married? Can I father a child or can I have, if it's a woman, can I carry a pregnancy to term? What are the options? And that's a very common question that I have with a younger patient.
Fortunately, as hard as these decisions are, there are good strategies available for preserving fertility with a little bit of care and planning.
There are several things one can do in advance. So the more in advance patient is informed, they have time to think about it. And either if they want to have a pregnancy, that they would plan a pregnancy if they're able to because they're not on any medications, or that they want to have a referral to the specialist for ova preservation or sperm preservation and banking and things of that nature. So you know, these days we have a lot of technology that make so much possible.
Unfortunately, these strategies can often be very expensive, so that needs to be planned as well.
Insurers, and I have to bring this up because there's the practice of medicine, but then there's the business of healthcare, and we have to consider both of them. Insurers do not, and you can argue this is shameful, do not universally cover oncofertility, meaning efforts to preserve someone's childbearing potential, even when it's endangered by life-saving cancer treatment.
All in all, these questions about family planning and fertility can sneak up on a young person who is already overwhelmed by dealing with cancer and can strike them in ways that they weren't expecting.
It brings up a lot of emotion, and I think it surprises a lot of people, you know, the emotion that it brings up, because it can feel like a real loss, kind of this loss of, you know, spontaneity around thinking about these things. And it turns into much more of like a medical plan and decision. And it's really hard. It's really hard.
Questions of family planning can be complicated by the fact that neuroendocrine cancers in younger people are sometimes caused by genetic conditions. And in many cases, these can be passed down from parent to child.
Neuroendocrine tumors that tend to happen in really young people, like adolescents, are probably driven by germline mutations. So meaning that they inherited that risk from their parents, or it actually happened de novo. So there are some mutations that your parents don't have at all, and they just happen in you. So tuberous sclerosis, for instance, is a condition where that actually happens more often than not, that the patient that's affected is the first one in their family to be affected.
Dr. Lewis has a genetic mutation called multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1, or MEN1, which affects a person's thyroid and often causes symptoms related to the way the body processes calcium, some of which can be quite painful and debilitating. In a significant percentage of patients, MEN1 can also cause the development of pancreatic NETs.
So PNETs in MEN1 are not universally prevalent. And the other word that we use in genetic syndromes is penetrant, meaning that if you have the mutation, how likely are you to have a given condition, like say PNETs in MEN1? So hyperparathyroidism is 100% penetrant in MEN1, meaning that if you have MEN1 and you live long enough, you will get hyperparathyroidism. The penetrance of PNETs is not nearly that high, and the estimates vary, but it's probably at least half.
Unfortunately, though, PNETs are the number one cause of premature death among people with MEN1.
You know, it used to be that MEN1 patients died of stomach ulcers. They don't anymore, thankfully, because our medicines have gotten so much better. Now the main threat to life is PNETs, and specifically PNETs that either are hormonally overactive and or PNETs that spread to the liver. So the reason I had my Whipple surgery in 2017 is my dominant PNET ahead of my pancreas was growing pretty quickly and pretty large and really posed a high risk of metastasis. And so I had that removed almost as a preventative maneuver. So far, 3 years later, my liver is clean, but that's why I had the surgery that I did.
For Dr. Lewis, as for many younger NET patients, diagnosis of both his NET and the underlying genetic condition that caused it came as a surprise.
When I was 30, I was just starting my cancer training. I had horrible abdominal pain, and showing you the folly of self-diagnosis, I actually thought it was appendicitis. But when I went in to get checked out, it was actually my calcium level was very high. And what that does is it's almost like the brakes on your gut. So I had a condition called ileus, where my bowel just wasn't moving at all. And that can be quite painful, and that's actually what was setting me off. So I'd already gone through medical school and residency, so I was committed to my profession. I'd already invested a lot of sweat equity and student debt at that point. So I was pretty convinced that this is what I wanted to do. And I was married, and so I almost sort of felt like I had sold my wife a bill of goods. Like when she married me, she didn't know sort of what she was getting into. And you can argue the other way too, is that when you already know as a young person that you're dealing particularly with a hereditary syndrome, it does affect your relationships and sometimes your sort of willingness to have a family. By the time I found my syndrome, I'd already had my daughter. And I kind of always wondered in hindsight, would our decisions around having a family have changed if we had known before we started having kids that I had this condition? Because there's a 50-50 chance that I would pass this on to each child. As it happens, that daughter is unaffected, but I also have a son who is affected. He's nine. His name is Alan, after my father. And he is a ball of energy. And he has zero, at this point, outward signs of MEN1. And my wife is a pediatrician. And we had a long talk, actually, especially once he tested positive, about how to tell him. And it's interesting, I've actually, people love to tell you how to parent. I think everybody has to kind of figure out how to do it on their own. But some people told us, or told me at least, that we've robbed him of his autonomy because we should have waited till he was 18 and then allowed him to find out, this on his own terms. Personally, I would not have wanted to celebrate my 18th birthday with news that I have a genetic condition. And I think the counter argument there is, to the extent that we can, we try to normalize this for him in the sense that he understands now when he goes to the doctor, it's slightly more involved than say when his sister goes to the doctor. So my son really has viewed our condition honestly as something that we share. We have a special handshake that we do, and he calls it our shared tummy troubles, which I find very endearing. And the other thing is, I'm an only child. So if I hadn't had an affected child, this syndrome and my sort of bloodline actually probably would have ended with me. So there is a little bit of guilt, to be honest with you, associated with the notion of transmitting the syndrome on. I took sort of a huge step towards prolonging my life by temporarily endangering it. So by doing the Whipple surgery in 2017, it's the largest operation I've had by a long shot. It was really an investment in my current state of health. So, it was a big, big surgery. I had complications from it. It required feeding tubes and a variety of other things for months on end. But ultimately, it's been worth it because now I'm here 3 years later. I feel fine. I do take pancreatic enzyme supplements because I have lost about half my pancreas and that affects digestion. Other than that, I feel great. I feel able to do the job that I love. I'm very active with my family and I'm very fortunate. But I also live in a state of, without sounding paranoid, surveillance.
As we come toward the end of this podcast, we'd like to offer three pieces of advice for younger people who are wrestling with a NET diagnosis. First, it may feel like your life is now entirely out of your control, but you might be surprised by how much control and confidence you can take back with a little thought, perspective, and patience.
When a cancer diagnosis comes up, it really feels as though all control has been lost. Particularly when, you're in the beginning of a career, you're in the beginning of a relationship, and then all of a sudden this big, huge thing comes up and it's like, I have no control over anything here. So I think really piecing apart the things, even if they're small, that you can control in a situation. You know, I often have patients make a list of the things in their day they can control and the things in their day they can't control. So, you know, getting a certain medication at a certain time, maybe you can't control. You probably can't. You know, the fact that you have cancer, you can't control. The things you can control are the routine you set for yourself. So the time you wake up in the morning, the individuals that you contact during the day, really kind of sussing out the specifics of what you do and do not have control over can feel really, really liberating. And also, you know, it's a good reminder that there are things that you have control over.
The second is that you are not alone. However rare your particular condition, there are others who know what you are going through. And because of the internet, there has never been a better time to find them.
So I've had several patients recently and heartbreakingly tell me, quote, "I'm the only person my age going through this." And that's another place where actually we can lean into advocacy organizations and support groups that allow people with really rare illnesses to come together and find that actually they do have kindred spirits. They might not live in their town. So when I was diagnosed with my condition, it was a 1 in 30,000 incidence in the United States. So I didn't know anybody who had MEN1. So actually, I found them online. That's how I found my community. And that's where I've stayed in oncology social media for over a decade now. So I think the other thing to realize in EYAs is they do get this sense that, oh my gosh, why is this happening to me? And why me? And why only me? And the latter part, I really try to mitigate by telling them, listen, you're not alone. And I think that's hugely empowering.
Some cancer centers, not all, have young adults support groups. I cannot recommend support groups enough, even for folks that don't think it's for them. I think try it. If you hate it, you never have to go back. Also, most support groups right now are virtual, so you don't even have to leave your space. The SAM Fund is an excellent resource. They have tons of information regarding grants and other financial tools that can be helpful for folks who are going through cancer treatment. The last one I will mention is Stupid Cancer, which is an organization solely based around young adults with cancer. And they have a conference every year. And this one is actually virtual and recorded. So there are sessions on everything from fertility to body image to navigating disability, things like that.
The third piece of advice is do not give up hope. There have never been more successful treatments for NETs than there are right now.
I think a lot of hope that I see and I have experienced within our field just of neuroendocrine tumors over last couple of decades that's, you know, keeps growing is that what has happened in the field about variety of progress in the testing, the diagnostics, as well as the treatment aspects of these cancers. So I would be the last person to tell somebody to say, gosh, okay, well, you know, these are the only choices you have. I tell them that these are the choices that you have now, but, you know, I am hopeful that there are more choices coming in coming times.
So the silver lining here, and I can't stress this enough, is that the prognosis for many young NET patients is actually very, very good. And I tell patients, my goal is to have a long-term relationship with them. And I, you know, I've moved practices, but I can envision taking care of some of my NET patients for decades.
Between the time we recorded her interview and when this episode was edited, Sophia Hurtado passed away. Despite her loss, her mother Marianne wanted Sophia's story to be shared. This episode is dedicated to her memory. Thanks for listening to NETWISE. I'm Elise Gellerman, and I'm the CEO of the NET Research Foundation. This episode was produced by David Hoffman of Citizen Race Car, assisted by Garrett Tiedemann. It was made possible by the generous support of Ipsen, the Vincent E. Taylor Patient Education Fund, Advanced Accelerator Applications, a Novartis company, and Lexicon Pharmaceuticals. Special thanks to everyone we interviewed for this episode. We are grateful for your expertise. This is a production of the Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation, where we're committed to improving the lives of patients, families, and caregivers affected by neuroendocrine cancer. by funding research to discover cures and more effective treatments, and providing information and educational resources. Please visit us at netrf.org.
This podcast is not intended as and shall not be relied upon as medical advice. The Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation encourages all listeners to discuss any scientific information found here with their personal oncologist, physician, and/or appropriate qualified health professional. Listening to this podcast does not constitute a patient-physician relationship. The Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation does not represent that any information provided here should supplant the reasoned, informed advice of a patient's personal oncologist, physician, or appropriate qualified health professional.